Hear me?
Okay. Just bear with me. Just to give you a little information about myself, a little bit of background about me. I grew up in Boston for many years. I went to a high school, an examination high school that I had to test to get into. My teenage years was very, really, very well. I had a mentor who went to Northeastern who guided me in entrepreneuring and how to just motivated me to do all the right things, and I had a really great teenage life. When I was about to graduate, I got in trouble. I did something, and I got in trouble, and I got arrested at the age of 18. I also was introduced to a chemical, and that had played a part of that arrest. That being said, I'm nervous, and I need to say, Father, just help me. So that being said, you know, I was able to, now 18, I always say part of my story is when I graduated in June, and I was supposed to go to college in the fall, I didn't. That chemical allowed my life to be destructive for a little bit. Somewhere around 21, I had a child, and did the best I can to raise my, as a single mother. I had this case that was hanging over my head. I need to say, reverse. I remember the judge telling me, "Why did you wait to become 18 to get caught and get in trouble?" And I didn't have an answer. I didn't know. I didn't know any better. So life went on. At 21, I went to community college, tried to get to degree because that's what the ethics I was brought up in. I was brought up in church. I was brought up in working hard, go for what you want, be educated, strive for the best. So I tried to do that at 21. At 25, I had a daughter now, and here I'm a single mother still in the school trying to become a nurse. I was able to get a couple of jobs even though I had this quarry over my head. And that's only through being able to talk to people one-to-one and letting them know who I was, and what I looked on paper was not who I appeared to be in present. And I'm really grateful for that. I need to say, however, as time grew on and I wound up what made me change my major is because when it came time to do a practicum, my quarry halted that. It said I could not do this. And now I'm somewhere in my 30s, and it's telling me I can't do this for something I did when I was 18. I was told through people growing up that just leave it open, you know, to explain your life, tell them who you are, and this would be okay. And I need to say, I realized that I had to remove that barrier totally when I was able to work with this financial institute that I got in as a mail clerk and worked my way up to financials. Transfer clerk, transferring thousands and thousands of dollars. And when the company bought out a very prestigious other insurance company in 2004, I was laid off because I was the last person in that position. And the Patriot Act came out around that time. That act allowed me to even be more hindered, which again kicked in some other low self-esteem. I'm not worthy. This thing is still on my coat strings. Why can I not get a job? At least now having the opportunity to meet people to just present myself. So the Patriot Act, which put me into a depression, which put me into, you know, picking them back up to self-medicate myself. So it was a really rough time. It was a really rough time. Since then, it's been really hard to find a job that I know I'm worthy of, that I'm capable of, that I've educated myself to do. I need to say I'm grateful for people one-to-one and knowing so I've been able to get some things, but not the things that I had aspired to be when I was 17, 18. Another reason, my son is, he's now 25. In the process of educating them and educating myself and teaching them what not to do and always be on the right path because of what I found my barriers to be, I was very protective mother. I sent them out to Melrose to get their education. My two children graduated from Melrose High. And on one particular day, my son called me and said he was arrested. He was 17 for mistaken identity. This person, my son now has a quarry. And I bawled. I cried because I realized that he was, the systems that were made were going to hinder him also. He's an amazing man, married with my two beautiful grandchildren, and I am so grateful that he is persevered, because that's what we do, we persevere no matter what. My daughter is now in college, so this is a beautiful thing. But I just had to keep on reminding him of how you have to be very careful in how you move and shift in life, and you'll be very aware of your surroundings, because anything can happen. One thing that may not even be your fault can change the destiny of you, of where you want to pursue. So how I got involved with Epica is still being depressed and still soothing myself. I decided to, about 18 months ago, to decide to move out to Worcester, try a different scene. The children are grown. They're out of the house now. Let me take care of Marinella and get back on the road. I need to say Epica came to this organization. Some beautiful, powerful women came to this to this facility and started talking about social injustice, and that just sparked something into me that I remember doing when in my teenage years when I was a radical and was passionate and wanted to just change things. And I needed to see that in my 40s. I needed to see that again. So since then, I've been a member. We've been changing laws, changing policies. I've been telling my story. I need to say that I have accomplished some things. I did decide to seal that quarry, and it's sealed. I did decide to go back to school on something different, and now I'm doing my clinicals in phlebotomy, which is something I wanted to do. So there are some hopes, but I'm really up here and telling my story for the people who doesn't have strength or have the power or can articulate to say, I need support, I need some help, I need some assistance. How do I go about this? And without allowing those assistance to be crutches, but to be a stepstone to persevere to something better. That's why I'm up here today. And I'm grateful for you all allowing us to come out and just speak with you. And I need to say, if it wasn't for my faith, through everything, I wouldn't be standing here today. And that's it for me.
Good morning. From Marinella's story, I'm reminded of a passage. Well, actually, somebody else was reminded me of a passage from 1 Corinthians 12:26. If one member suffers, you all suffer together. If one member is honored, we all rejoice together. And I'm also told that there's a Buddhist that reminds people of the Buddhist notion of interdependence and the Jewish notion that there is a mutual contraction. So we can all rejoice in Marinella's tragedy made from some mistakes, but more important, her triumph over a system that is pernicious and over obstacles that most of us, at least myself and many people I know, would find almost impossible to overcome. So we're here today to talk about those obstacles and that system and what we can do as individuals and members of groups such as yours to shrink those obstacles and overturn that system. I'm reminded by Marinella and her colleagues at EPICA that we are one race. And the obstacles that we're here to talk about, Theodore Parker, from the reading we heard this morning, was also talking about. If he came back, I'm sure that he would be overwhelmed by the wealth that he could never have imagined would be created in the 100 years. But he would be shocked to see the disparities that still exist and the reasons that have not changed for that existence. The numbers that Allison mentioned that I was shocked by when I read the new Jim Crow was the fact that the United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. That in itself is not too shocking because we have 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of everything. Everything, even more. So why shouldn't we have 25% of the world's prisoners? But if you look at the graph, over hundreds of years, we imprisoned basically the same proportion of the population that we always have, maybe 150 per 100,000. Then all of a sudden, in the early 1970s, it began to climb. Until 2011, we were imprisoning 5 times that. 5 times more than per capita any country in the world. Everyone else basically maintained the same level over that same period of time. What was happening? GDP was growing. Incredible amounts. People were making hundreds of millions and then billions of dollars. What was happening over those 30 to 40 years that resulted in this incarceration of the masses? But it turns out it's not the incarceration of the masses. There is a disparity that is very familiar. 1 in 17 white males can expect to be incarcerated. 1 in 3 black males can be expected to be incarcerated. The hue of your brown skin, the darker it is, the longer your sentence for the same crime. For the same crime, black males are 5 times more likely to be incarcerated than white males for the same crime. And in Massachusetts, our very blue state, guess what? We're behind the curve. Over the last 3 years, our numbers have gone up to 24,000, while nationally, it's pretty much peaked. 2011 was the top, 2 million prisoners. It's basically peaked and starting to go down. The numbers of dollars that we expend on rehabilitation over the last 3 years shrank 15%. It used to be all of $12 million, and now it's down to 10. That's for rehabilitation. Recidivism rates have climbed close to 70%. It means this is recycling the same people. We're the first state in 10 years to pass a 3 strikes and you're out law. and our racial disparities 50% higher than it is nationally. 50% higher. Blacks are 8 times more likely to be imprisoned for the same crime than whites in Massachusetts. So why is this persisting, and what to do about it? Well, I'm very humble, and no way am I going to try to replicate Michelle Alexander's words, because she inspired me. The why is poverty, racism, and a culture of punishment. You can read, if you haven't read New Jim Crow, I urge you to read it. I urge you to read The Anatomy of the American Criminal Justice System by Robert Ferguson, a professor of law at Harvard. And I urge you to read Texas Tough. I urge you to see The House I Live In and to hear Michelle Alexander speak. I didn't realize Theodore Parker, 120 years ago, identified exactly the same causes for crime as Nicholas Katzenbach did in 1965 when he went to Johnson and said, "President Johnson, crime is driven by, guess what? Poverty, inadequate housing, insufficient education. A war on crime is not putting people in jail. It's a war on those factors. That should be the war." Well, here we are, 100 years later, 50 years later. We still have 20% of the population as a whole, and if you go inside racial groups, it's more than 20%. It's more like 60% in poverty, undereducated. And Michelle Alexander, when I heard her speak about a movement, I said, "That's right. Nothing short of a human rights movement is going to change this situation." So when I was in Boston Workers Alliance last July with my wife, and we heard Steve O'Neill and Cassandra Ben-Sahi from EPICA present this Jobs Not Jails campaign, these light bulbs went off in our heads. We turned to each other and said, "Oh my gosh, there is a movement building in Massachusetts. Let's get involved." And this movement has 3 goals, which I think some of you have heard about, and that is to enact legislation to ease the suffering of those currently in prison. Everything from mandatory minimums to shackling during labor to solitary confinement. We have a list on the table in the study room in the back of all the legislative reforms. Second, halt plans to construct new prisons completely until those reforms are taking effect. And thirdly, redirect monies aimed to building new prisons, redirect that money into constructing everything but prisons, and take the $150 million a year needed to run those new prisons and turn those into jobs programs for the most vulnerable among us. It was a speech by Steve that, and Cassandra that said to my wife and me, there is a movement here that can bring together everyone who is working on this issue, but not forgetting what Michelle Alexander is admonishing us not to forget, what is driving this. So don't just work on this particular legislative reform or this little jobs program. That is not going to solve the underlying driving problems. We have to confront what we have allowed to persist and currently exist. And so I urge you to sign this petition that's in the back, but take empty ones, get your family, friends, neighbors to sign it, hold signing events. That'll get you involved. That'll make you understand more deeply what the issues are. And then, as importantly, come to the rally on April the 26th. The rally is planned for 12 to 4 o'clock on April the 26th, where 10,000 people on the Boston Common with 50,000 signatures all taped to an orange banner. Let me see, that's about a mile long orange banner on the Boston Common. Can you imagine what that would say to our political leadership? More than having the usual suspects appear at a Harvard Law School forum where the candidates talk about the same thing they've always talked about. Oh, no, we need more education. We need more of this. We need more of that. That would really make a statement in my field, in my judgment. And the role of the faith-based community is absolutely critical to this. I was told by someone who's been working on mass incarceration issues for 30 years, last July, nothing is going to change in this state. Nothing. Because our legislature respond to their voters. And guess what? Their voters are not the ones who are affected by the system. Their voters are indifferent or hostile. But that's not been my experience over the last 5 months. I have found unawareness is the most common experience that I've seen. Unawareness about how badly Massachusetts fares, and unawareness of some of these drivers of mass incarceration. So can you imagine hundreds, if not thousands? Bill Gardner, UU minister from Arlington, he says he wants to bring 1,000 UUs to the Boston Common, 10% of the 10,000 goal. Wow. If that was the case, we would have 100,000 people on the Boston Common. And he wanted to have a service before the rally at the Arlington Street Church. Unfortunately, we just discovered that the sanctuary is taken on the 26th. So we're looking for other locations. The Baptists have a big church. There's an Episcopal/Jewish church on Newbury Street. Can you imagine the hundreds of thousands of people, not hundreds of thousands, but hundreds or thousands, pouring out of their centers of worship to go through the Boston Garden and then onto the rally? What that would say to our legislators? Then yes, we will back efforts to enact legislation to limit incarceration to those who are really, really bad. And secondly, to address the poverty that fuels mass incarceration and help us to confront the racism that drives it. That could be a really powerful statement. And then we would get back to the essence of what Marinello was saying and 1 Corinthians. We would heal many, many more parts of the whole. Thank you very much.